Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I was skeptical about ordering foundation online. I can't even find a match in stores. Then I discovered Il Makiage. Their online quiz found my exact shade in seconds. With Try Before You Buy, you can try your full-size shade at home free for 14 days. But I was obsessed on day one. It's so lightweight and natural, it's literally my skin in a bottle. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. That's ilmakiage.com/quiz.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 20th of June. Our main stories: a US court rejects a legal attempt to ban President Trump's first election rally since the lockdown. The American Secretary of State warns Europe over its economic links with China. And
it took a lot of efforts, a lot of yes, no, and finally they agreed. This is a place I never thought I would ever get to visit, the Foreign Intelligence Headquarters.
How our correspondent managed to secure an interview with a senior Russian spy. And later in the podcast,
when I was 4 years old, if you ask me, kids want to be an astronaut, a soccer star, or a psychopath or something, I would say no, I want to be an author, I want to be a writer.
We look back at the life of Spanish novelist Carlos Ruiz Zafón. When President Trump said he wanted to hold his first post-coronavirus election rally in the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, on Friday the 19th of June, he was accused of disrespecting African Americans. June the 19th is the day when the US marks the official end of slavery in 1865, and Tulsa was the scene of an infamous massacre of black Americans in 1921. So the president eventually agreed to postpone the event until Saturday the 20th. However, businesses and residents in the city were still unhappy and filed a legal challenge on the grounds that the rally could spread the coronavirus. On Friday, the Oklahoma Supreme Court ruled it could go ahead. We'll hear more about that in a moment. But first to the Juneteenth rallies, which took place on Friday and which were given added resonance by the killing of George Floyd.
It's such a change in history. I feel like I want to tear up as I see this change. I know a man lost his life because of this, but it was not in vain, so I had to come.
Events took place from Fort Worth in Texas to Brooklyn in New York.
I'm so excited to see so many young kids here. What will they say about us? What will we prepare for them for that they can live in a better society, in a just society where they are not judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character? Keep on going.
And those demands for racial justice were echoed in Atlanta, Chicago, Washington, and other American cities. I heard more from our correspondent, David Willis.
For many white people, this is an anniversary that up to now has largely passed without notice. This year, of course, the day that marks the end of slavery here in the United States, is all the more relevant given the high profile nature that race relations have acquired here in the US in the wake of George Floyd's death. There was no address by President Trump to mark Juneteenth, but some in Congress have expressed support for making this day a national holiday here. So clearly views are changing on that.
And let's look at that rally in Tulsa, because President Trump tweeted his praise for Juneteenth, talking about equality of all Americans, and at the same time as threatening protesters in Oklahoma.
Yes, he is. He says that in a tweet that any protesters, anarchists, agitators, looters or lowlives, as he called them, will be dealt with harshly by Oklahoma police. He's making the point that there will be no sort of kid gloves approach, as he sees it, to demonstrators that has been witnessed in places such as New York, where the president believes authorities have been too soft. And the Oklahoma Supreme Court has rejected an attempt to stop that Tulsa campaign rally from taking place over health concerns. It's the first rally of its kind since the coronavirus shut down public gatherings here more than 3 months ago. And some local residents and business owners in Tulsa fear the event could actually worsen the spread of the coronavirus. And they wanted to see the arena where the rally is due to take place be compelled to adhere to social distancing guidelines. Now, the Trump campaign says that it will be up to those attending whether they want to wear face coverings, but they are not required and there will be no observance of social distancing guidelines.
David Willis. Staying in the US, the American Secretary of State has angrily denounced China's economic links with Europe. In an unusually critical speech, Mike Pompeo told Europeans that relying on Beijing would mean abandoning democracy.
Party that wants to throw away the progress we in the free world have made through NATO and other institutions, both formal and informal institutions, and adopt a new set of rules and norms to accommodate them is in Beijing. I don't believe that there's a uniquely European or American way to face this choice. There's also no way to straddle these alternatives without abandoning who we are. Democracies that are dependent on authoritarians are not worthy of their name.
The US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The World Health Organization has said the coronavirus pandemic is entering a new and dangerous phase, with infections accelerating even as people grow weary of lockdowns. On Thursday, there were a record 150,000 new cases around the world, half coming from the Americas. The WHO's specialist on the response to COVID-19, Dr. Maria Van Kerkhove, said it was vital to remain vigilant.
This pandemic is accelerating in many parts of the world. And so while we have seen countries have some success in suppressing transmission and bringing transmission down to a low level, every country must remain ready. And if countries are seeing some success and are considering lifting the lockdowns, we need to ensure that we are all using this time wisely to ensure that our systems are in place to be at the ready to detect any cases, any resurgence in cases.
Meanwhile, Italy's health agency has warned people there to remain cautious after two outbreaks in Rome, though it said the overall situation was generally positive. Italy was the first nation in Europe to be overwhelmed by COVID-19 after recording its first locally transmitted case in February. But now a study has found the virus was circulating in northern Italy as early as December. They were able to identify traces of SARS-CoV-2 in sewage samples in three cities. Luca Lucentini is one of the researchers.
We repeated the tests in two different laboratories with two different methods. So we are sure that these positive results are the first evidence of the presence of virus in these cities in the north of Italy. Even if we can't say if this was the first day or the circulation started before. Unfortunately, we have not enough samples to have an accurate evolution of this phenomenon.
Our correspondent in Rome, Mark Lowen, told me more about the findings.
Well, these are researchers from the National Health Institute of Italy, the largest public health institute here, and they have confirmed what was long suspected here, Ollie, which is that even well before the first official cases of coronavirus were recorded in the northern Italian region of Lombardy at the end of February, which led to the eruption of coronavirus in Europe, that actually the virus was circulating here for some time. They collected wastewater samples from three northern Italian cities, Milan, Turin and Bologna. And they found that in the first two, Milan and Turin, they could find traces of coronavirus from the middle of December. That's around about the first time that coronavirus was recorded in China, some 2 months before it was officially recorded in Italy. And then a month later in January, it was present in wastewater samples in Bologna. So why is this important? Well, because we still don't really know how coronavirus arrived in Italy. So-called patient zero has never been identified. So this could help shed light on the origins of coronavirus here. And of course, it shows that once again, how wastewater samples are important for tracking the trajectory of coronavirus around the world.
Yeah, do they have any idea of how the virus got into Italy and the rest of Europe?
I mean, there have been various theories flying around, some which suggest that the origin actually came from Germany, somebody who came from Germany into Italy, northern Italy, who had some kind of link with China. But that's never been conclusively proved. And actually, once the outbreak got out of control here, the focus of the story shifted from kind of who is patient zero to actually how do we stop this thing from spreading so fast.
Yeah, what's been the reaction to the news that the virus was circulating long before the authorities realised?
Well, the authorities up in Lombardy, which is Italy's wealthiest region and indeed one of Europe's wealthiest regions, are quite defensive about how they responded to and handled this whole outbreak. I've just returned from a couple of weeks up in Lombardy, and I spoke to the president of the region, Attilio Fontana. An inquiry is already underway into what mistakes he and other regional staff may have made in handling the outbreak at the start, particularly, for example, slow lockdowns in parts of the region, but he defended his authorities' response.
Nessuno ci aveva avvisato della possibilità che arrivasse una pandemia.
Neither the government nor our scientists told us a pandemic was a realistic possibility here. When I and some of my colleagues told the state that we needed to take some precautionary measures regarding people arriving from China, we were accused of being racist and were told there was nothing to fear. The reality is that the only body that has the power to suspend people's right to move about freely is the government. Only it can establish a red zone. The president of the region has no security force, police force or military force.
So you can get a sense there of the kind of passing of the buck that is taking place now between local politicians, regional politicians and the national government in Rome. And this is all going to come out a lot in the next few weeks and months as that sort of to-ing and fro-ing continues. And the relatives of the victims, of almost 35,000 victims, really try to work out whether and how this tragedy could have been eased.
Mark Lowen in Rome. Sergei Naryshkin is the head of Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR. He's previously been a speaker of Russia's lower parliament, the Duma, and is reported to have once served in the KGB. He is a prominent figure, but he rarely, if ever, speaks to foreign journalists. But our Moscow correspondent Steve Rosenberg managed to secure an exclusive interview with Mr. Naryshkin, and he told Julian Marshall how he did it.
It took a lot of effort, a lot of letters, a lot of telephone calls, a lot of yes, no, and finally they agreed. It was quite surreal. This is a place I never thought I would ever get to visit, the Foreign Intelligence Headquarters. It's based outside Moscow. It's very well guarded, of course, and it's a giant sprawling territory. It's like a city within a city. We were told that we were the first foreign broadcasters to be let in, so naturally security was tight. We were checked and then we were driven at breakneck speed by an SVR driver to a kind of a guest house away from the main building. That's where the interview was going to take place. And in walked Sergei Naryshkin, who is a very powerful figure in Russia, long-time ally of Vladimir Putin. We had a quick chat before the interview began, during which he told me that he didn't think much of James Bond, which was quite interesting. Then off we went with the interview. And we talked about the lack of trust between Russia and the West right now. And I said, well, you can understand why there's no trust. I mean, look at all the things Russia has been accused of, like waging a hybrid war against the West with cyber attacks and disinformation. He hit back and said Washington was trying to rule the world. And then briefly, we talked about the Salisbury poisoning, the attack on Sergei and Yulia Skripal, which Britain is convinced the Russian state organized. This was Mr. Naryshkin's response.
We don't trust what the British government's been saying about Salisbury. When they say it's highly likely that Russia's to blame, we're not convinced by that.
But a lot of our conversation was actually devoted to the Second World War, or what is known here in Russia as the Great Patriotic or the Great Fatherland War. And that is because, curiously, Russia's spy chief is also head of the Russian Historical Society. Now, in recent years, Russia has been accused of trying to rewrite history, including the history of World War II, to make the past look more glorious. But in the interview today, Sergei Naryshkin hit back. He accused the West of revisionism and of trying to downplay, to diminish Moscow's role in defeating Adolf Hitler.
Many young people in the West and Eastern Europe think it was the USA alone that defeated Nazi Germany and liberated Europe. Such ignorance is not accidental. It's deliberate. To create the impression that everything good in the past and the present is connected with one country, America.
Steve, did Mr. Nryshkin have anything positive to say about the West?
Well, he had particular praise for one Englishman, Winston Churchill. He told me that he was shocked to learn that recently the Winston Churchill statue in London had been targeted by protesters.
Churchill was a great man, a great political leader. I think it's a real shame about the statue. How can you treat your own history like that?
Sergei Nryshkin, head of Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, talking to Steve Rosenberg. And still to come on the podcast, COVID-19 and violence against women. We hear from victims of abuse in South Africa.
We saw grotesque acts of domestic violence taking place and people really having no options and no support structure that they could go to.
The Spanish novelist Carlos Ruiz Zafón has died in Los Angeles at the age of just 55. He'd been diagnosed with colon cancer. He rose to fame after The Shadow of the Wind was published in 2001. The novel is set in his native Barcelona after the Spanish Civil War. Richard Hamilton looks back at his life.
Carlos Ruiz Zafón's 8 novels have been translated into more than 40 languages, and around 38 million copies have been sold worldwide. His most successful novel, The Shadow of the Wind, is a gothic noir historical thriller which became part of a quartet known as The Cemetery of Forgotten Books. Interviewed at the Library of Congress Book Festival in 2016, Ruiz Zafón said he wanted Barcelona not simply to be a backdrop to the novel, but a character in its own right, a kind of sorceress with many dark secrets. It took him a while to find his voice after starting in young adult fiction. Here he is talking at the same festival.
I always knew I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to make a living writing stories, writing books, and that was my calling. And when I was 4 years old, if you ask me, kids want to be an astronaut, a soccer star, or a psychopath or something, I was saying, no, I want to be an author. I want to be a writer. And for me, it was very clear. The only thing was, how do I convince the world that this is such a clear thing? And it took me a few years. But at some point, I managed to do that, and I became, when I was 20-something, a full-time writer, and that's what I've been doing for my entire adult life.
Although they have a cinematic quality, Ruiz Zafón never allowed his books to be adapted for the screen, saying they were a homage to the written word. His Spanish publishers said his death marked the loss of one of the world's best contemporary novelists, and quoted a line from The Shadow of the Wind: "Every book, every volume you see here has a soul, the soul of the person who wrote it."
Richard Hamilton. South Africa has some of the worst levels of violent crime in the world, much of it directed against women. More than 2,700 women were killed there last year. And the government says attacks on women and girls increased drastically under the coronavirus lockdown. Our South Africa reporter, Pumza Filani, looks at what's being done to stop it.
Hundreds of people who are supposed to be under lockdown have poured onto the streets of Soweto to mourn Tshegofatso Bole. She was 8 months pregnant when she was found stabbed, hanging from a tree. Here in South Africa, more than 2,700 women were murdered last year. That's one woman every 3 hours. And before the lockdown, an average of 100 rapes were reported every day. But experts say that's just a fraction of what's really going on.
Heels together. So there's the kit.
Before the lockdown, at a health centre in Johannesburg for survivors of sexual violence, we met a woman who had been attacked the previous day. This is not her real voice.
I just turned and then I felt someone was hitting me.
What did he hit you with?
A beer bottle.
A beer bottle. Okay.
And then he grabbed me and says, "Shut up." I was ashamed to go home even, because I didn't ask for it.
You didn't ask for it, and no one deserves that. It's not supposed to happen in that way.
She told us she was worried no one would believe her, and worse, that nothing would happen to the man that raped her. Last year, things reached a tipping point as protests swept across the country after the murder of 19-year-old Uyinen Mkhwetyana. She was a student who was raped and killed when she went to a post office to collect a parcel.
Women are dying with protection orders in their homes.
As a result, President Cyril Ramaphosa declared violence against women a national crisis, and the government has since given more money to special sexual crimes courts, places of safety, and even training for the police. But advocates say lockdown has brought new challenges.
No one could move around, so even if you wanted to leave your abuser, you couldn't leave.
Mandisa Kanyile is with Rise Up, a women's rights group based in Johannesburg.
We saw grotesque acts of domestic violence taking place and people really having no options and no support structure that they could go to.
The world looks at us as a destination for femicide.
At the root of the issue, the government acknowledges it's the attitude and behavior of men that needs to change. Patrick Shai, a reformed abuser, teaches scores of men how to recognize harmful behavior.
We've got so many excuses. So let us begin to look deeper into ourselves.
We as guys like to demand respect. We are too oppressive.
When I was growing up, my dad used to abuse my mother in front of me.
We must take this curriculum, this conversation, into our homes.
And it's this combination of community work and education that activists say will break the cycle of violence.
Change begins with you.
It's clear some things are beginning to change, but managing the spread of coronavirus has meant that most of these programs have had to be put on hold, and that has advocates worried that violence will go unchecked and more lives will be lost.
And when it's not allowed, that means coercion.
A report from South Africa by Pumza Filani. An investigation is underway in Romania after a former Iranian judge was found dead at a hotel in Bucharest. Ghulam Reza Mansouri fled Iran last year after being accused of corruption and human rights abuses, including the arrest and torture of journalists. G.R. Gol from our BBC Persian service told me more about him.
He was a cleric and high-profile judge and prosecutor in Iran. He has been accused during the previous head of judicial system. He was involved in bribery, €500,000, and obviously he has been in Europe since summer last year, and he said in a video after this accusation against him in Iranian court, he said he was in Europe and seeking treatment. But obviously earlier this month, he was arrested in Romania under request of Iranian Interpol officials, and also actually in the same time, Reporters Without Borders and many journalist organizations abroad, they asked a Romanian official to detain him and try him for violation of human rights in Iran and torturing journalists during his time as a prosecutor.
And what is known about how he died in Romania?
Well, the police says a hotel staff, a hotel he was staying, one of the posh hotel in Bucharest, found him on the floor dead. They believe he may have fallen, actually, from the higher flats. Most likely, some say it might be a suicide. But ironically, actually, one of the high advisor to senior, actually, advisor to Iran's president said he is linked with one of the corruption, high-profile people with corruption who have a network within all three branches of government in Iran. It's most likely they have pushed him out from this world. He implies he may have been killed from some elements inside Iran. But obviously, the Romanian police, so far they say, it seems he may have committed suicide.
G.R. Gol of the BBC Persian service. A luxury Paris hotel is selling off more than 1,000 lots after a $130 million revamp. This report from Vahana Darwood. In all
the American writer Ernest Hemingway once said, "When I dream of afterlife in heaven, the action always takes place in the Paris Ritz." Anything goes. Now the hotel is selling off the crystal martini glasses from its legendary bar Hemingway, the blue and gold Limoges service commissioned by César Ritz himself, and other delights. In total, over 1,000 lots of tableware, glassware, silverware and linen are up for sale in a three-day auction starting Sunday. The opulent Palace Hotel has a long association with illustrious figures from the arts, including Cole Porter, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and the French fashion designer Coco Chanel is said to have spent part of World War II tucked up there with her lover, a German spy. An auction of furniture held by the hotel 2 years ago raised nearly $8 million, but this weekend's auction may prove more accessible. Estimates range from just $100 for two ashtrays from the Ritz Club to $200 to $300 for two teapots. Every lot is said to be a piece of history.
Vahana Darwood reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.